He was careful not to look too obviously out of the gate as he crossed the street. He found Cummings in the guardhouse, standing inside the door. A good young sergeant, Cummings was. He had the new look of the Corps. Breckinridge was built along the classic John Wayne lines, with broad shoulders and imposing bulk. Cummings was a black kid, a runner who had the frame of a Frank Shorter. The boy could run all day, something that the gunny had never been able to do. But more than all of that, Cummings was a lifer. He understood what the Marine Corps was all about. Breckinridge had taken the young man under his wing, imparting a few important lessons along the way. The sergeant major knew that he would soon be part of the Corps' past. Cummings was its future, and he told himself that the future looked pretty good. "Hey, Gunny," the sergeant greeted him. "The guy in the doorway. He's been there since a little after 4. He don't live here." Cummings paused for a moment. He was, after all, only a buck sergeant with no rockers under his stripes, talking to a man whom generals addressed with respect. "It just feels funny." "Well, let's give him a few minutes," Breckinridge thought aloud. "God, I hate grading quizzes." "So go easy on the boys and girls," Robbie chuckled. "Like you do?" Ryan asked. "I teach a difficult technical subject. I have to give quizzes." "Engineers. Shame you can't read and write as well as you multiply." "You must have taken a tough pill this afternoon, Jack." "Yeah, well." The phone rang. Jack picked it up. "Dr. Ryan." "Yes?" "Who?" His face changed. His voice became guarded. "Yes, that's right." Robbie saw his friend go stiff in the chair. "Are you sure? Where are they now?" "Okay. Okay, thank you. Thank you." Jack stared at the phone for a second or two before hanging it up. "What's the matter, Jack?" Robbie asked. It took him a moment to answer. "That was the police. There's been an accident." "Where are they?" Robbie said immediately.
They flew them to Baltimore."
Jack stood shakily.
"I have to get there."
He looked down at his friend.
"God, Robbie."
Jackson was on his feet in an instant. "Come on. I'll take you up there."
"No,
Stuff it, Jack. I'm driving." Robbie got his coat and tossed Jack's over the desk. "Move it, boy."
"They took them by helicopter."
"Where?" "Where to, Jack?"
"University," he said.
"Get it together, Jack." Robbie grabbed his arm. "Settle down some." The flyer led his friend down the stairs and out of the building. His red Corvette was parked 100 yards away. "Still there?" the civilian guard reported when he came back in. "Okay," Breckinridge said, standing. He looked at the pistol holster hanging in the corner, but decided against that. "This is what we're going to do." Ned Clark didn't like the mission from the first moment. Sean was too eager on this one. But he hadn't said so. Sean had masterminded the prison break that had made him a free man. If nothing else, Ned Clark was loyal to the cause. He was exposed here, and didn't like that either. His briefing had told him that the guards at the academy gate were lax, and he could see that they were unarmed. They had no authority at all off the grounds of the school. But it was taking too long. His target was 30 minutes late. He didn't smoke, didn't do anything to make himself conspicuous, and he knew that he'd be hard to spot. The doorway of the tired old apartment building had no light. One of Alex's people had taken care of that with a pellet gun the previous night. "Ought to call this one off," Clark told himself. But he didn't want to do that. He didn't want to fail Sean. He saw a pair of men leave the academy. Bootnecks. Bloody Marines in their Sunday clothes. They looked so pretty without their guns. So vulnerable.
So the captain, he says, the big one was saying loudly, get that goddamn gook off my chopper.
And the other one started laughing.
I love it. How about a couple of beers, the big one said next.
They crossed the street, heading his way.
Okay by me, Gunny. You buying? My turn, isn't it? I have to get some money first.
The big one reached in his pocket for some keys and turned toward Clark.
Excuse me, sir. Can I help you?
His hand came out of his pocket without any keys. Clark reacted quickly, but not quickly enough. The right hand inside his overcoat started moving up, but Breckenridge's own right grabbed it like a vice.
I ask if I could help you, sir, the sergeant major said pleasantly. What do you have in that hand?
Clark tried to move, but the big man pushed him against the brick wall.
Careful, Tom, Breckenridge warned.
Cummings' hand searched downward and found the metallic shape of a pistol.
Gun,
he said sharply.
It better not go off,
the gunny announced, his left arm across Clark's throat.
Let the man have it, sonny, real careful-like.
Clark was amazed at his stupidity, letting them get so close to him. His head tried to turn to look up the street, but the man waiting for him in the car was around the corner. Before he could think of anything to do, the black man had disarmed him and was searching his pockets. Cummings removed the knife next.
Talk to me, Breckenridge said.
Clark didn't say anything, and the forearm slid roughly across his throat.
Please talk to me, sir. Get your bloody hands off of me. Who do you think you are?
Where are you from, boy? Breckenridge didn't need an answer to that one. The sergeant wrenched Clark's arm out of the pocket and twisted it behind his back.
Okay, sonny, we're going to walk through that gate over yonder, and you're going to sit down and be a good boy while we call the police. If you make any trouble, I'm going to tear this arm off and shove it right up your ass. Let's go, boy.
The driver who'd been waiting for Clark was standing at the far corner. He took one look at what had happened and walked to his car. 2 minutes later, he was blocks away. Cummings handcuffed the man to a chair while Breckenridge established that he carried no identification, aside from an automatic pistol, which was ID enough. First he called his captain, then the Annapolis City Police. It started there, but though the gunny didn't know, it wouldn't stop there. Chapter 15. Shock and Trauma. If Jack had ever doubted that Robbie Jackson really was a fighter pilot, this would have cured him. Jackson's personal toy was a 2-year-old Chevrolet Corvette, painted candy apple red, and he drove it with a sense of personal invincibility. The flyer raced out the academy's west gate, turned left, and found his way to Roe Boulevard. The traffic problems on Route 50 West were immediately apparent, and he changed lanes to head east. In a minute, he was streaking across the Severn River Bridge. Jack was too engrossed in his thoughts to see much of anything, but Robbie saw what looked like the remains of a Porsche on the other side of the roadway. Jackson's blood went cold as he turned away. He cast the thoughts aside and concentrated on his driving, pushing the Corvette past 80. There were too many cops on the other side of the road for him to worry about a ticket. He took the Ritchie Highway exit a minute later and curved around north toward Baltimore. Rush hour traffic was heavy, though most of it was heading in the other direction. This gave him gaps to exploit, and the pilot used every one. He worked up and down through the gears, rarely touching the brakes. To his right, Jack simply stared straight ahead, not seeing much of anything. He managed to wince when Robbie paused behind 2 tractor trailers running side by side, then shot up right between them with scant inches of clearance on either side. The outraged screams of the 2 diesel horns faded irrelevantly behind the racing vet, and Jack returned to the emptiness of his thoughts. Breckenridge allowed his captain, Mike Peters, to handle the situation. He was a pretty good officer, the sergeant major thought, who'd had the common sense to let his NCOs run things. He'd managed to get to the guard shack about 2 minutes ahead of the Annapolis City Police, long enough for Breckenridge and Cummings to fill him in.
"So what gives, gentlemen?" the responding officer asked.
Captain Peters nodded for Breckinridge to speak. "Sir, Sergeant Cummings here observed this individual to be standing over at the corner across the street. He did not look like a local resident, so we kept an eye on him. Finally, Cummings and I walked over and asked if we might be of assistance to him. He tried to pull this on us." The gunny lifted the pistol carefully so as not to disturb the fingerprints. "And he had this knife in his pocket. Carrying a concealed weapon is a violation of local law, so Cummings and I made a citizen's arrest and called you. This character does not have any identification on him, and he declined to speak with us." "What kind of gun is that?" the cop asked. "It's an FN 9mm, Breckinridge answered. "It's the same as the Browning High Power, but a different trademark, with a 13-round magazine. The weapon was loaded, with a live round in the chamber. The hammer was down. The knife is a cheap piece of shit. Punk knife." The cop had to smile. He knew Breckinridge from the Department Firearms Training Unit. "Can I have your name, please?" the cop said to Eamon Clark. The suspect just stared at him. "Sir, you have a number of constitutional rights which I am about to read to you, but the law does not allow you to withhold your identity. You have to tell me your name." The cop stared at Clark for another minute. At last he shrugged and pulled a card from his clipboard. "Sir, you have the right to remain silent." He read the litany off the card. "Do you understand these rights?" Still Clark didn't say anything. The police officer was getting irritated. He looked at the other three men in the room. "Gentlemen, will you testify that I read this individual his rights?"
"Yes, sir, we certainly will," Captain Peters said.
"If I may make a suggestion, officer," Breckinridge said, "you might want to check this boy out with the FBI.
"How come?"
"He talks funny," the sergeant major explained. "He don't come from here."
"Great. Two crazy ones in one day."
"What do you mean?" Breckinridge asked.
"Little while ago, a car got machine-gunned on 50. Sounds like some kind of drug hit. A trooper got killed by the same bunch a few minutes later. The bad guys got away."
The cop leaned down to look Clark in the face.
"You better start talking, sir. The cops in this town are in a mean mood tonight. What I'm telling you, man, is that we don't want to put up with some unnecessary shit. You understand me?"
Clark didn't understand. In Ireland, carrying a concealed weapon was a serious crime. In America, it was rather less so, since so many citizens owned guns. Had he said he was waiting for someone and carried a gun because he was afraid of street criminals, he might have gotten out on the street before identification procedures were complete. Instead, his intransigence was only making the policeman angry and ensuring that the identification procedures would be carried out in full before he was arraigned. Captain Peters and Sergeant Major Breckinridge exchanged a meaningful look.
"Officer," the captain said, "I would most strongly recommend that you check this character's ID with the FBI. We had a sort of an informal warning about terrorist activity a few weeks back. This is still your jurisdiction, since he was arrested in the city, but..."
"I hear you, Captain," the cop said. He thought for a few seconds and concluded that there was something more here than met the eye. "If you gentlemen will come to the station with me, we'll find out who Mr. Doe here really is."
Ryan charged through the entrance of the Shock Trauma Center and identified himself to the reception desk, whose occupant directed him to a waiting room where, she said firmly, he would be notified as soon as there was anything to report. The sudden change from action to inaction disoriented Jack enormously. He stood at the entrance to the waiting room for some minutes, his mind a total blank as it struggled with the situation. By the time Robbie arrived from parking his car, he found his friend sitting on the cracked vinyl of an old sofa, mindlessly reading through a brochure whose stiff paper had become as soft as chamois from the numberless hands of parents, wives, husbands, and friends of the patients who had passed through this building. The brochure explained in bureaucratic prose how the Maryland Institute for Emergency Medical Services was the first and best organization of its kind, devoted exclusively to the most sophisticated emergency care for trauma victims. Ryan knew all this.
Johns Hopkins managed the more recent pediatric unit and provided many of the staff surgeons for eye injuries. Kathy had spent some time doing that during her residency, an intense 2 months that she'd been happy to leave behind. Jack wondered if she were now being treated by a former colleague. Would he recognize her? Would it matter? The Shock Trauma Center, so known to everyone but the billing department, had begun as the dream of a brilliant, aggressive, and supremely arrogant heart surgeon who had bludgeoned his way through a labyrinth of bureaucratic empires to build this 21st-century emergency room. It had blossomed into a dazzling, legendary success. Shock trauma was the leading edge of emergency medical technology. It had already pioneered many techniques for critical care, and in doing so had overthrown many historical precepts of conventional medicine, which had not endeared its founder to his medical brethren. That would have been true in any field, and Shock Trauma's founder had not helped the process with his brutally outspoken opinions. His greatest, but unacknowledged, crime, of course, was being right in nearly all details. And while this prophet was without honor in the mainstream of his profession, its younger members were easier to convert. Shock Trauma attracted the best young surgical talent in the world, and only the finest of them were chosen. But will they be good enough? Ryan asked himself. He lost all track of time, waiting, afraid to look at his watch, afraid to speculate on the significance of time's flight. Alone, completely alone in his circumscribed world, he reflected that God had given him a wife he loved and a child he treasured more than his own life, that his first duty as husband and father was to protect them from an often hostile world, that he had failed, that because of this their lives were now in strangers' hands. All his knowledge, all his skills were useless now. It was worse than impotence, and some evil agency in his mind kept repeating over and over the thoughts that made him cringe as he retreated further and further into catatonic numbness. For hours he stared at the floor, then at the wall, unable even to pray as his mind sought the solace of emptiness. Jackson sat beside his friend, silent, in his own private world. A naval aviator, he had seen close friends vanish from a trivial mistake or a mechanical glitch, or seemingly nothing at all. He'd felt death's cold hand brush his own shoulder less than a year before. But this wasn't a danger to a mature man who had freely chosen a dangerous profession. This was a young wife and an innocent child whose lives were at risk. He couldn't joke about how old Dutch would luck this one out. He knew nothing at all he could say, no encouragement he could offer other than just sitting there. And though he gave no sign of it, Robbie was sure that Jack knew his friend was close at hand. After 2 hours, Jackson quietly left the waiting room to call his wife and check discreetly at the desk. The receptionist fumbled for the names, then identified them as a female, blonde, age 30 or so, head, and a female, blonde, age 4 or so, flailed chest. The pilot was tempted to throttle the receptionist for her coldness, but his discipline was sufficient to allow him to turn away without a word. Jackson rejoined Ryan a moment later, and together they stared at the wall through the passage of time. It started to rain outside, a cold rain that perfectly matched what they both felt. Special Agent Shaw was walking through the door of his Chevy Chase home when the phone rang. His teenage daughter answered it and just held it out to him. This sort of thing was not the least unusual.
Shaw here. Mr. Shaw, this is Nick Capitano from the Annapolis office. The city police here have in custody a man with a pistol, a knife, but no ID. He refuses to talk at all, but earlier he did speak to a couple of Marines, and he had an accent.
That's nice. He has an accent. What kind? Shaw asked testily.
Maybe Irish, Capitano replied. He was apprehended just outside Gate 3 of the U.S. Naval Academy. There's a Marine here who says that some teacher named Ryan works there, and he got some sort of warning from the anti-terrorism office.
What the hell?
Have you ID'd the suspect yet?
No, sir. The local police just fingerprinted him.
and they faxed a copy of the prints and photo to the Bureau. The suspect refuses to say anything. He just isn't talking at all, sir.
Okay. Shaw thought for a moment. So much for dinner. I'll be back in my office in 30 minutes. Have them send a copy of the mugshot and the prints there. You stay put and have somebody find Dr. Ryan and stay with him.
Right.
Shaw hung up and dialed his office at the Bureau. Dave, Bill, call London and tell Dan Murray I want him in his office in half an hour. We may have something happening over here.
Bye, Daddy, his daughter said. Shaw hadn't even had time to take off his coat. He was at his desk 27 minutes later. First, he called Nick Capitano in Annapolis.
Anything new?
No, sir. The security detail at Annapolis can't find this Ryan guy. His car is parked on the academy grounds, and they've got people looking for him. I've asked the Anne Arundel County Police to send a car to his home in case he got a ride. Car broke down or something like that. Things are a little wild here at the moment. Something crazy happened about the same time this John Doe gunman got picked up. A car got hosed down with a machine gun just outside the city.
What the hell was that?
The state police are handling it. We haven't been called in, Capitano explained.
Get a man over there,
Shaw said at once. The secretary came into the office and handed him a folder. Inside was a facsimile copy of the suspect's mugshot. It showed full face and profile.
Hold it!
He caught the secretary before the door was closed. I want this fax to London right now.
Yes, sir.
Shaw next dialed the tie line to the embassy in London.
I just got to sleep, the voice answered after the first ring.
Hi, Dan. I just missed dinner. It's a tough world. I have a photo being faxed to you now.
Shaw filled Murray in on what had happened.
Oh, my God.
Murray gulped down some coffee.
Where's Ryan?
We don't know. Probably just wandering around somewhere. His car's still parked in Annapolis. At the academy, I mean. The security guys are looking for him.
He's gotta be all right, Dan.
If I read this right, the suspect in Annapolis was probably waiting for him.
The photograph of Eamon Clark was already in the embassy. The Bureau's communications unit worked on the same satellite net used by the intelligence services. The embassy communications officers were actually employees of the National Security Agency, which never slept. The facsimile had arrived with a flash priority header, and a messenger ran it up to the legal attaché's office. But the door was locked. Murray had to set the phone down to open it.
I'm back, Murray said. He opened the folder. The photo had suffered somewhat from twice being broken into electronic bits and broadcast, but for all of that it was recognizable.
This one's familiar. I can't put a name on him, but he's a bad guy.
How fast can you ID him?
I can call Jimmy Owens real quick. You in your office?
Yeah, Shaw answered.
I'll be back.
Murray changed buttons on his phones. He didn't have Owens' home number memorized and had to look it up.
Yes. Hi, Jimmy. It's Dan.
Murray's voice was actually chipper now.
Have I got something for you?
Owens didn't know that yet.
Do you know what time it is? Our guys have somebody in custody that you may be interested in. Who? Owens asked. I got a picture, but no name. He was arrested in Annapolis, outside the Naval Academy. Ryan? Maybe.
Murray was worried about that.
Meet me at the yard, Owens said.
On the way.
Murray headed downstairs for his car. It was easier for Owens. His house was always watched by a pair of armed detectives in a police car. All he had to do was step outside and wave, and the Land Rover came to his door. He beat Murray by 5 minutes. By the time the FBI agent arrived, Owens had already consumed a cup of tea. He poured two more.
This guy look familiar?
The FBI agent tossed the photo over. Owen's eyes went wide.
Ned Clark, he breathed. In America, you say? I thought he looked familiar. He got picked up in Annapolis. This is one of the lads who broke out of Long Cache. A very bad boy with several murders to his name.
Thank you, Mr. Murray.
Thank the Marines. Murray grabbed a cup of tea. He really needed the caffeine. Can I make a call? Within a minute he was back to FBI headquarters. The desk phone was on speaker so that Owens could listen in. Bill, the suspect is one Ned Clark, a convicted murderer who escaped from prison last year. He used to be a big-time assassin with the Provos.
I got some bad news, Dan, Shaw replied. It appears that there was an attack on this Ryan fellow's family. The state police are investigating what looks like a machine gun attack on a car belonging to Dr. Caroline Ryan, M.D. The suspects were in a van and made a clean escape after killing a state trooper.
Where is Jack Ryan? Murray asked.
We don't know yet. He was seen leaving the Naval Academy grounds in the car of a friend. The troopers are looking for the car now.
What about his family?
It was Owens this time.
They were flown to the Shock Trauma Center in Baltimore. The local police have been notified to keep an eye on the place, but it's usually guarded anyway. As soon as we find Ryan, we'll put some people with him.
Okay, on this Clark kid, I'll have him in federal custody by tomorrow morning. I expect that Mr. Owens wants him back?
Yes.
Owens leaned back in his chair. He had his own call to make now. As often happened in police work, there was bad news to accompany the good.
Mr. Ryan?
It was a doctor. Probably a doctor. He wore a pink paper gown and strange-looking pink booties over what were probably sneakers. The gown was blood-stained. He couldn't be much over 30, Ryan judged. The face was tired and dark. Dr. Barry Shapiro, the name tag announced, Deputy Trauma Surgeon in Chief. Ryan tried to stand but found that his legs would not work. The doctor waved for him to remain seated. He came over slowly and fell into the chair next to the sofa.
What news do you bring me?
Ryan thought. His mind both screamed for information and dreaded learning what had happened to his family.
I'm Barry Shapiro. I've been working on your daughter.
He spoke quickly, with a curious accent that Ryan noted but discarded as irrelevant.
Okay, your wife is fine. She had a broken and lacerated upper left arm and a nasty cut on her head. When the helicopter paramedic saw the head wound, heads bleed a lot. He brought her here as a precaution. We ran a complete head protocol on her, and she's fine. A mild concussion, but nothing to worry about. She'll be fine.
She's pregnant.
We noticed. Shapiro smiled. No problem with that. The pregnancy has not been compromised in any way.
She's a surgeon.
Will there be any permanent damage?
Oh, I didn't know that. We don't bother very much with patient identification, Shapiro explained. No, there should be no problem. The damage to her arm is extensive but routine. It should heal completely.
Ryan nodded, afraid to ask the next question. The doctor paused before going on.
Does the bad news come next? Your daughter is a very sick little girl.
Jack nearly choked with his next breath. The iron fist that had clutched his stomach relaxed a millimeter.
At least she's alive.
Sally's alive.
Apparently she wasn't wearing her seatbelt. When the car hit, she was thrown forward, very hard. Jack nodded. Sally liked to play with her seatbelt buckle.
We thought it was cute, Ryan reminded himself bitterly.
Okay. Tib and fib are broken in both legs, along with the left femur. All of the left side ribs are broken, and six on the right side. A classic flailed chest. She can't breathe for herself, but she's on respirator. That is under control. She arrived with extensive internal injuries and hemorrhaging, severe damage to the liver and spleen and the large bowel. Her heart stopped right after she got here, probably, almost certainly from loss of blood volume. We've got it restarted at once and immediately started replacing the blood loss. Shapiro went on quickly. That problem is also behind us. Dr. Kinter and I have been working on her for the best part of 5 hours. We had to remove the spleen.
That's okay. You can live without a spleen. Shapiro didn't say that the spleen was an important part of the body's defense against infections. The liver had a moderately extensive stellate fracture and damage to the main artery that feeds blood into the organ. We had to remove about a quarter of the liver. Again, no problem with that. And I think we fixed the arterial damage, and I think the repair will hold. The liver is important. It has a great deal to do with blood formation and the body's biochemical balance. You can't live without it. If liver function is maintained, she'll probably make it. The damage to the bowel was easy to repair. We removed about 30 centimeters. The legs are immobilized. We'll repair them later. The ribs, well, that's painful but not life-threatening. And the skull is relatively minor. I guess her chest took the main impact. She has a concussion, but there's no sign of intracranial bleeding. Shapiro rubbed his hands over his heavily bearded face. The whole thing revolves around her liver function. If the liver continues to work, she will probably recover fully. We're keeping a very close watch on her blood chemistry, and we'll know something in, oh, maybe 8 or 9 hours.
Not till then?
Ryan's face twisted into an agonized mass. The fist tightened its grip yet again.
She still might die?
Mr. Ryan, Shapiro said slowly, I know what you are going through. If it hadn't been for the helicopter bringing your little girl in, well, right now I'd be telling you that she had died. Another 5 minutes getting here, maybe not that long, and she would not have made it this far. That's how close it was. But she is alive now, and I promise you that we're doing our very best to keep her that way. And our best is the best there is. My team of doctors and nurses is the best of its kind in the world. Period. Nobody comes close. If there's a way, we'll find it. And if there's not, he didn't say, we won't.
Can I see them?
No. Shapiro shook his head. Right now, both of them are in the CCRU, the Critical Care Recovery Unit. We keep that as clean as an OR. The smallest infection can be lethal for a trauma patient. I'm sorry, but it would be too dangerous to them. My people are watching them constantly. A nurse, an experienced trauma nurse, is with each of them every second, with a team of doctors and nurses 30 feet away.
Okay.
He almost gasped the word. Ryan leaned his head back against the wall and closed his eyes.
8 more hours? But you have no choice. You have to wait. You have to do what they say.
Okay. Shapiro left, and Jackson followed after him, catching him by the elevator.
Doc, can't Jack see his little girl? She...
Not a chance. Shapiro half fell against the wall and let out a long breath. Look, right now, the little girl...
What's her name, anyway?
Sally. Okay. Right now, she's in a bed, stark naked, with IV tubes running into both arms and one leg. Her head's partially shaved. She's wired up to a half dozen monitors, and we have an Engstrom respirator breathing for her. Her legs are wrapped. All you can see of her is one big bruise from her hips to the top of her head. Shapiro looked down at the pilot. He was too tired to show any emotion. Look, she might die. I don't think so, but there's no way we can be sure. With liver injuries, you can't tell until the blood chemistry readings come in. You just can't. If she does die, would you want your friend to see her like that? Would you want him to remember her like that for the rest of his life?
I guess not, Jackson said quietly, surprised at how much he wanted this little girl to live. His wife could not have children, and somehow Sally had become like their own. What are her chances?
I'm not a bookie. I don't quote odds. Numbers don't mean a thing in a case like this. Sorry, but either she makes it or she doesn't. Look, that wasn't a song and dance I gave. Jack, you said, she could not be in a better place.
Shapiro's eyes focused on Jackson's chest. He jabbed a finger at the wings of gold.
You a pilot?
Yeah, fighters.
Phantoms?
No, the F-14. Tomcat.
I fly. Shapiro smiled. I used to be a flight surgeon in the Air Force. Last year I got a sailplane. Nice and peaceful up there. When I can get away from this madhouse, I go up every time I can. No phones, no hassles. Just me in the clouds.
The doctor was not talking to Jackson so much as himself. Robbie set his hand on the surgeon's arm.
Doc, tell you what. You save that little girl, and I'll get you a check ride in any bird you want. Ever been up in a T-38?
What's that?
Shapiro was too tired to remember that he'd seen them before. A spiffy little supersonic trainer. Two seats, dual controls, and she handles like a wet dream. I can disguise you as one of ours and get you up no sweat. Ever been past Mach 1?
No.
Can you do some aerobatics? Shapiro smiled like a tired little boy.
Sure, Doc.
Jackson grinned, knowing that he could do maneuvers to make a quail lose its lunch.
I'll take you up on that. We work the same way with every patient, but I'll take you up on that anyway. Keep an eye on your friend. He looks a little rocky. That's normal. This sort of thing can be harder on the family than it is on the victims. If he doesn't come around some, tell the receptionist. We have a staff psychiatrist who specializes in working with the other victims, he calls them.
Yet another new idea at Shock Trauma was a specialist in helping people cope with the injuries to family and friends.
Kathy's arm. She's an eye surgeon. Lots of fine work, you know.
You sure there's no problem with that?
Shapiro shook his head.
No big deal. It was a clean break to the humerus. Must have been a jacketed slug. The bullet went in clean, went out clean. Pretty lucky, really.
Robbie's hand clamped shut on the doctor's arm as the elevator arrived.
Bullet? Didn't I say that? God, I must be tireder than I thought. Yeah, it was a gunshot wound, but very clean. Hell, I wish they were all that clean. A 9mm, maybe a 38, about that size. I have to get back to work.
The doctor went into the elevator.
Shit, Jackson said to the wall.
He turned when he heard a man with an English accent. Two of them, it turned out, whom the receptionist directed to the waiting room. Robbie followed them in. The taller one approached Ryan and said, Sir John. Ryan looked up.
Sir John? Robbie thought.
The Brit drew himself to attention and went on briskly.
My name is Geoffrey Bennett. I am chargé d'affaires at the British Embassy.
He produced an envelope from his pocket and handed it to Ryan.
I am directed by Her Majesty to deliver this personally into your hand and to await your reply.
Jack blinked his eyes a few times, then tore open the envelope and extracted a yellow message form. The cable was brief, kind, and to the point.
What time is it over there? Ryan wondered.
2 in the morning? 3? Something like that.
That meant that she'd been awakened with the news, probably, and cared enough to send a personal message, and was waiting for a reply.
How about that?
Ryan closed his eyes and told himself that it was time to return to the world of the living. Too drained for the tears he needed to shed, he swallowed a few times and rubbed his hands across his face before standing.
Please tell Her Majesty that I am most grateful for her concern. My wife is expected to recover fully. But my daughter is in critical condition, and we will have no definitive word on her for another 8 or 9 hours. Please tell Her Majesty that I am
deeply touched by her concern, and that all of us value her friendship very highly indeed.
Thank you, Sir John. Bennett made some notes. I will cable your reply immediately. If you have no objection, I will leave a member of the embassy staff here with you.
Jack nodded, puzzled, as Bennett made his exit.
Robbie took all this in with a raised eyebrow and a dozen unasked questions. Who was this guy? He introduced himself as Edward Wason and took a seat in the corner facing the doorway. He looked over at Jackson. Their eyes met briefly, and each man evaluated the other. Wason had cool, detached eyes and a wispy smile at the corners of his mouth. Robbie gave him a closer look. There was a slight bulge under his left arm. Wason affected to read a paperback novel, which he held in his left hand, but his eyes kept flickering to the door every few seconds, and his right hand stayed free in his lap. He caught Jackson's glance and nodded.
So, Robbie concluded, a spook, or at least a security officer.
So that's what this is all about.
The realization came as a blast of cold air. The pilot's hands flexed as he considered the type of person who would deliberately attempt to murder a woman and her child. 5 minutes later, three state police officers made their belated arrival. They talked to Ryan for 10 minutes. Jackson watched with interest and saw his friend's face go pale with anger as he stammered answers to numerous questions. Wason didn't look, but heard it all.
"You were right, Jimmy," Murray said.
He was standing at the window, watching the early morning traffic negotiate the corner of Broadway and Victoria.
"Paddy O'Neill in Boston likes to say what wonderful chaps Sinn Féin are," Owen said speculatively. "And our friend O'Donnell decides to embarrass them. We could not have known, Dan. A possibility of a suspicion is not evidence, and you know it. There was no basis, in fact, for giving them a more serious warning than what you did. And you did warn them, Dan.
She's a pretty little girl.
Gave me a hug and a kiss before they flew home."
Murray looked at his watch again and subtracted 5 hours.
"Jimmy, there are times.
15 years ago, we arrested this person who went after kids. Little boys. I interrogated him. Sang like a canary. He couldn't be happier with himself. He copped to 6 cases, gave me all the details with a big shit-eating grin. It was right after the Supreme Court struck down all the death penalty laws, so he knew that he'd live to a ripe old age. Do you know how close I came to—"
He stopped for a moment before going on.
"Sometimes we're too damn civilized. The alternative, Dan, is to become like them. I know that's true, Jimmy, but I just don't like it right now."
When Barry Shapiro next checked his watch, it was 5 in the morning.
"No wonder I feel so tired," he thought. 20 hours on duty. "I'm too old for this." He was senior staff. He was supposed to know better.
The first sign was staying on duty too long, taking on too much personal responsibility, taking too keen an interest in patients who in the final analysis were nothing more or less than bruised and broken pieces of meat. Some of them died. No matter how great his skill, how refined his technique, how determined the efforts of his team, some would always die. And when you got this tired, you couldn't sleep. Their injuries, and worse, their faces, were too fresh in your memory, too haunting to go away. Doctors need sleep more than most men. Persistent loss of sleep was the last and most dangerous warning. That was when you had to leave, or risk a breakdown, as had happened all too often to the shock trauma staffers. It was their grimmest institutional joke, how their patients arrived with broken bodies and mostly went home whole, but the staff doctors and nurses who came in with the greatest energy and highest personal ideals would so often leave broken in spirit. It was the ultimate irony of his profession that success would engender the expectation of still greater success, that failure in this most demanding of medical disciplines could leave almost as much damage on the practitioner as the patient. Shapiro was cynic enough to see the humor of it. The surgeon reread the printout that the blood analyzer unit had spat out a minute before and handed it back to the nurse practitioner. She attached it to the child's chart, then sat back down, stroking her dirty hair outside the oxygen mask. "Her father is downstairs. Get relief here and go down and tell him." "I'm going upstairs for a smoke." Shapiro left the CCRU and got his overcoat, fishing in his pockets for his cigarettes. He wandered down the hall to the fire stairs, then climbed slowly up the 6 flights to the roof. "God," he thought. "Dear God, I'm tired." The roof was flat, covered with tar and gravel, spotted here and there with the UHF antennas for the center's SISCOM communications net, and a few air-conditioning condensers. Shapiro lit a cigarette in the lee of the stairway tower, cursing himself for his inability to break the noxious habit. He rationalized that, unlike most of his colleagues, he never saw the degenerative effects of smoking. Most of his patients were too young for chronic diseases. Their injuries resulted from the miracles of a technical society: automobiles, motorcycles, firearms, and industrial machinery. Shapiro walked to the edge of the roof, rested his foot on the parapet as though on a bar rail, and blew smoke into the early morning air. It wafted away to appear and disappear as a gentle morning breeze carried it past the rooftop lights. The doctor stretched his tired arms and neck. The night's rain had washed the sky clean of its normal pollution, and he could see stars overhead in the pre-dawn darkness. Shapiro's curious accent resulted from his background. His early childhood had been spent in the Williamsburg section of New York, the son of a rabbi who had taken his family to South Carolina. Barry had had good private schooling there, but emerged from it with a mixture of Southern drawl and New York quip. It was further damaged by a prairie twang acquired during his medical training at Baylor University in Texas. His father was a distinguished man of letters in his own right, a frequent lecturer at the University of South Carolina at Columbia. An expert in 19th-century American literature, Rabbi Shapiro's specialty was the work of Edgar Allan Poe. Barry Shapiro loathed Poe. A scribbler of death and perversity, the surgeon called him whenever the subject came up, and he'd been surprised to learn that Poe had died in Baltimore long before, after falling asleep, drunk, in a gutter, and that Poe's home was only a few blocks from the University Hospital complex, a demi-shrine for the local literati. It seemed to the surgeon that everything about Poe was dark and twisted, always expecting the inevitability of death. Violent, untimely death, Shapiro's own very personal enemy. He had come to think of Poe as the embodiment of that enemy, sometimes beaten, sometimes not. It was not something he talked about to the staff psychiatrist, who also kept a close eye on the hospital staff. But now, alone, he looked north to the Poe house. "You son of a bitch," he whispered. To himself, to Poe, to no one. "You son of a bitch. Not this time. You don't get this one. This one goes home." He flicked the cigarette away and watched the point of orange light fall all the way to the shining empty street. He turned back to the stairs. It was time to get some sleep.
Chapter 16. Objectives and Patriots. Like most professional officers, Lieutenant Commander Robbie Jackson had little use for the press. The irony of it was that Jack had tried many times to tell him that his outlook was wrong, that the press was as important to the preservation of American democracy as the Navy was. Now, as he watched, reporters were hounding his friend with questions that alternated between totally inane and intrusively personal.
Why did everyone need to know how Jack felt about his daughter's condition? What would any normal person feel about having his child hovering near death? Did they need such feelings explained? How was Jack supposed to know who'd done the shooting? If the police didn't know, how could he?
And what's your name?
One finally asked Robbie. He gave the woman his name and rank, but not his serial number.
What are you doing here? She persisted.
We're friends. I drove him up here. You dumbass.
And what do you think of all this?
What do you think I think? If that was your friend's little girl up there, what the hell would you think? The pilot snapped back at her.
Do you know who did it?
I fly airplanes for a living. I'm not a cop. Ask them.
They're not talking.
Robbie smiled thinly. Well, score one for the good guys. Lady, why don't you leave that man alone? If you were going through what he is, do you think you would want a half-dozen strangers asking you these kind of questions? That's a human being over there, you know? And he's my friend, and I don't like what you people are doing to him.
Look, Commander, we know that his wife and daughter were attacked by terrorists.
Says who? Jackson demanded.
Who else would it be? Do you think we're stupid?
Robbie didn't answer that.
This is news. It's the first attack by a foreign terrorist group on American soil, if we're reading this right. That is important. The people have a right to know what happened and why, the reporter said reasonably.
She's right, Robbie admitted reluctantly to himself. He didn't like it, but she was right.
Damn. Would it make you feel any better to know that I do have a kid about that age? Mine's a boy, she said.
The reporter actually seemed sympathetic. Jackson searched for something to dislike about her. Answer me this. If you have a chance to interview the people who did this, would you do it?
That's my job. We need to know where they're coming from.
Where they're coming from, lady, is they kill people for the fun of it. It's all part of their game. Robbie remembered intelligence reports he'd seen while in the Eastern Med. Back a couple of years ago. You never heard this from me, okay?
Off the record, she said solemnly.
I was on a carrier off Beirut, okay? We had intelligence reports and pictures of people from Europe who flew in to do some killing. They were mainly kids, must have been from good families. I mean, from the way they dressed. No shit, this is for real. I saw the friggin' pictures. They joined up with some of the crazies, got guns, and just started blasting away at random for the pure hell of it. They shot from those high-rise hotels and office buildings into the streets. With a rifle, you can hit from 1,000 yards away. Something moves, boom, they blast it with automatic weapons fire. Then they got to go home. They were killing people for fun. Maybe some of them grew up to be real terrorists, I don't know. It was pretty sickening stuff, not the sort of thing you forget. That's the kind of people we're talking about here, okay? I don't give a good goddamn about their point of view, lady. When I was a little kid in Alabama, we had problems with people like that, those assholes in the Klan. I don't give a damn about their point of view either. The only good thing about the Klan was they were idiots. The terrorists we got running around now are a lot more efficient. Maybe that makes them more legitimate in your eyes, but not mine.
That thing in Beirut never made the papers, the reporter said.
I know for a fact that one reporter saw it. Maybe he figured that nobody would believe it. I don't know that I would have without the photos. But I saw 'em. You got my word on that, lady.
What kind of pictures?
That I can't say. But they were good enough to see their shiny young faces. The photos had been made by U.S. and Israeli reconnaissance aircraft.
So what do you do about it?
If you could arrange to have all these bastards in one place, I think we and the Marines could figure something out, Robbie replied, voicing a wish common to professional soldiers throughout the world. We might even invite you newsies to the wake.
Who the hell is that?
two new people came into the room. Jack was too tired to be fully coherent. The news that Sally was out of immediate danger had been like a giant weight leaving his shoulders, and he was waiting for the chance to see his wife, who would soon be moved to a regular hospital floor. A few feet away, Wason, the British security officer, watched with unconcealed contempt, refusing even to give his name to the reporters who asked. The state police officers were unable to keep the press away, though hospital personnel flatly refused to let the TV equipment in the front door and were able to make that stick. The question that kept repeating was, who did it? Jack said he didn't know, though he thought he did. It was probably the people he'd decided not to worry about. It could have been worse, he told himself. At least it was now probable that Sally would be alive at the end of the week. His daughter was not dead because of his misjudgment. That was some consolation. Mr. Ryan, one of the new visitors asked.
Yeah.
Jack was too exhausted to look up. He was awake only because of adrenaline now. His nerves were too ragged to allow him to sleep, much as he needed it.
I'm Special Agent Ed Donahoe, Boston Field Office of the FBI. I have somebody who wants to say something to you.
Nobody ever said that Patty O'Neill was stupid, Donahoe thought. As soon as the report had made the 11 o'clock news, the man from Sinn Féin had asked his FBI escort if he might fly down to Baltimore. Donahoe was in no position to deny him the right, and had been co-opted into bringing the man himself on the first available plane into BWI.
Mr. Ryan, O'Neill said with a voice that dripped sympathy, I understand that the condition of your child has been upgraded. I hope that my prayers had something to do with it. And
it took Ryan over 10 seconds to recognize the face that he'd seen a few days before on TV. His mouth slowly dropped open as his eyes widened. For some reason, he didn't hear what the man was saying. The words came through his ears, but as though they were in some unknown tongue, his brain did not assemble them into speech. All he saw was the man's throat, 5 feet away. Just about 5 feet, was what his brain told him. Uh-oh, Robbie said on the other side of the room. He stood as his friend went beet red. 2 seconds later, Ryan's face was as pale as the collar on his white cotton shirt. Jack's feet shifted, sliding straight beneath his body as he leaned forward on the couch. Robbie pushed past the FBI agent as Ryan launched himself from the couch, hands stretching out for O'Neill's neck. Jackson's shoulder caught his friend's chest, and the pilot wrapped Jack up in a bear hug, trying to push him backward as 3 photographers recorded the scene. Jack didn't make a sound, but Robbie knew exactly what he wanted to do. Jackson had leverage going for him and pushed Ryan back, hurling him onto the couch. He turned quickly.
Get that asshole out of here before I kill him!
Jackson was 4 inches shorter than the Irishman, but his rage was scarcely less than Ryan's.
Get that terrorist bastard out of here!
Officer! Special Agent Donahoe pointed to a state trooper, who grabbed O'Neill and dragged him from the room in an instant. For some reason, the reporters followed as O'Neill loudly protested his innocence.
"Are you out of your fucking mind?"
Jackson snarled at the FBI agent. "Cool down, Commander. I'm on your side, okay? Cool it down some." Jackson sat down beside Ryan, who was breathing like a horse at the end of a race while he stared at the floor. Donahoe sat down on the other side.
Mr. Ryan, I couldn't keep him from coming down. I'm sorry, but we can't do that.
He wanted to tell you... Shit, all the way down on the plane he told me that his outfit had nothing to do with this. That it would be a disaster for them. He wanted to extend his sympathy, I guess. The agent hated himself for saying that, even though it was true enough. He hated himself even more because he'd almost started to like Patty O'Neill over the past week. The front man for Sinn Féin was a person of considerable charm, a man with a gift for presenting his point of view in a reasonable way. Ed Donahoe asked himself why he'd been assigned to this job. Why couldn't they have picked an Italian? He knew the answer to that, of course, but just because there was a reason didn't mean that he had to like it.
I'll make sure he doesn't bother you anymore.
You do that, Robbie said. Donahoe went back into the hall and unsurprisingly found O'Neill giving his spiel to the reporters.
Mr. Ryan is distraught, he was saying, as any family.